debacle unfolded just a day after a triple suicide bombing in the Ben Yehuda pedestrian mall in Jerusalem, an attack that Israeli intelligence had no advance knowledge of, and only weeks before the disastrous Mossad attempt on Khaled Mashal in Jordan. In many ways, then, September 1997 marked one of the lowest ebbs in Israeli intelligence history. Each of three different intelligence arms had racked up a number of failures. The Shin Bet had failed to protect the prime minister or to stop a wave of suicide bombings. The Mossad had not managed to target the command centers of the jihadist terror organizations abroad. Amman's efforts to penetrate and disrupt Hezbollah had been far from effective, and the latter two had altogether missed, as it would later transpire, the WMD projects of Iran, Syria, and Libya. The Ansaria debacle, meanwhile, intensified the public controversy over the Israeli military presence in Lebanon, which some saw as comparable to the American embroilment in Vietnam. Protests demanding withdrawal were led by the Four Mothers, a movement named after the four matriarchs of the Bible, started by four women whose sons were serving in the IDF in Lebanon. The IDF and the political leadership treated them with contempt. One senior officer called them the four dish rags, but their protests were resonating. Because of the Ansaria disaster, the targeted killings in Lebanon stopped. The IDF repeatedly put forward ideas for killing Hezbollah officers, but they were rejected by the chief of staff or by the weekly operations and sorties forum with the Minister of Defense. Hezbollah hadn't become less of a menace, but targeting its officers had become more of a potential political liability. The Mossad, fresh off nearly destroying diplomatic relations with Jordan, botched another operation barely 5 months later, this time in Switzerland. The target was Abdallah Zain, a senior figure in Hezbollah's logistical and financial network. The Mossad's plan was to tap his telephone, keep him under surveillance, and eventually kill him. But they made enough noise trying to install a bug in the basement of Zain's apartment building that they woke up an old lady who called the police. One operative was arrested. Mossad chief Danny Yatom, after one too many botched plans, resigned. Yatom was replaced by Ephraim Halevi, who had scored points with Netanyahu for the way he handled the Mashal case. Afraid of any more fiascos, Halevi effectively shut down Kisaraya, refusing to approve almost every high-risk operation and allowing the unit to decay. "It can honestly be stated," said Avi Dichter, who was deputy head of the Shin Bet at the time and would become head of that agency in 2000, "that the defense establishment was not giving the people of Israel the protective shield that they deserved." That would be worrisome under any circumstances, but it was especially so in the late 1990s, because Israel's enemies were becoming more menacing, from Iran to Libya, from Hezbollah in Lebanon to Hamas in Gaza and Amman. A front of adversaries had been created who were much more innovative and determined than anything the Mossad, Amman, or the Shin Bet had grappled with before. The Shin Bet was the first of the intelligence agencies to regain its footing. Its chief, Ami Ayalon, and the inquiry panels he set up to find out what had gone wrong reached the conclusion that the Shin Bet had become weak and ineffective in two of its main areas of activity. The first was the acquisition of information. For decades, the Shin Bet had relied upon intelligence obtained from human sources, but this reservoir had almost dried up. No substitute had yet been found for the hundreds of Palestinian agents that it had lost when Israel withdrew from Palestinian territory after the Oslo Accords. The Shin Bet failed to develop alternative methods and was unable to recruit agents inside Hamas, an ideological religious movement whose members were less likely to be tempted by bribes. One of the Shin Bet inquiry panels put it succinctly and damningly: "The organization is not attuned to the environment it works in." The second inadequacy was what the Shin Bet did with information once it was obtained. Ayalon visited the organization's archives and stared incredulously at the huge containers stuffed with hundreds of thousands of cardboard binders. "We are behaving like a medieval organization," he told the senior command forum of the Shin Bet. "An archive like this does not make it possible to construct a real-time intelligence picture. Even if all the information were to be found in the files, it wouldn't help us at all." Ayalon declared that the Shin Bet is not an intelligence body, but rather a preventive body. In other words, the agency's purpose was not merely to gather information for the sake of collection, but rather to thwart the enemy's intentions in real time. In order to do so, the Shin Bet had to collect intelligence and analyze it in the briefest of time spans. Ayalon argued that the solution was to be found in advanced technologies. Tech-based sources would replace human sources, producing a multidimensional, real-time intelligence picture. In 1996, these were revolutionary thoughts that generated a crisis of confidence in the Shin Bet, drew harsh criticism of Ayalon, and even led many to quit the agency. But Ayalon stuck to his guns. He created a number of new teams and departments that developed cutting-edge techniques for collecting information, penetrating various data systems and intercepting emails, phone calls, and, later on, social media communications. They also developed new ways to use the information, state-of-the-art techniques for analyzing vast amounts of data and extracting the most important bits of intel. Ayalon and his tech teams shifted the focus of the Shin Bet so that more emphasis was placed on the connections between people, more emphasis on the network rather than on each separate individual. The Shin Bet was the first to grasp the huge potential of tracking mobile phones, first through the phone calls themselves, and later through geolocation, texting, video transmissions, and online surfing. Under Ayalon, the agency's entire operational structure changed. It no longer relied on regional case officers deployed geographically, who ran agents and functioned more or less independently, but instead concentrated activities around a desk, whose personnel sat at computer monitors, gathering information, piecing it together, and ordering operatives to gather missing pieces of the puzzle. The makeup of Shin Bet's personnel was also changing rapidly. Many of the agency's old case officers left, while young men and women from the IDF's tech units were being recruited at a quick pace. Soon, 23% of the agency's personnel were operatives trained extensively in the development of innovative technologies. "We set up an entire division of Qs," said Diskin, referring to the tech wizard of James Bond movies. "In it, dozens of amazing startups are underway simultaneously." The first problem the newly revamped Shin Bet had to deal with was Mohi al-Din Sharif, a student of Yahya Ayash's, who became the Hamas military wing's top explosives expert after Ayash's assassination, and who was known as Engineer Number 2. Ayash and his deputy at the time, Hassan Salameh, had taught Sharif to make improvised bombs out of a very powerful explosive material, triacetone triperoxide, as they themselves had learned from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Sharif was the one who had built the bombs that were used in the 4 suicide attacks Hamas launched to avenge Ayash's death. Like Ayash before him, Sharif trained others in his craft, teaching a squad of men in Jerusalem how to configure remote-controlled bombs, build time-delayed fuses, and improvise explosives from readily available materials. He also taught them how to hide bombs in video cassettes. 11 such cassettes were made in a plot to detonate them at bus stops, lottery stalls, and phone booths. One of them blew up in Netanya on February 11, 1998. Wounding 10 civilians. The Shin Bet identified the bomb makers before they planted the others and arrested them, thereby preventing a major disaster. The Shin Bet compiled a thick dossier on Sharif, monitoring his movements and habits by tracking the calls and locations of mobile phones he and some of his men used. Most critically, the agency uncovered a plot to detonate a massive bomb stuffed inside a Fiat Uno on the eve of Passover, when Jerusalem's sidewalks would be crowded with people doing last-minute holiday shopping. The Shin Bet's operations wing, the Birds, managed to attach a detonator to the Fiat before Sharif delivered it to the suicide bomber. On March 29, 1998, when Sharif drove the car into a garage in Ramallah, away from innocent civilians, it exploded. Even with Sharif's demise and the arrest of many of his associates, the Shin Bet sensed that a piece was missing from the puzzle. The agency concluded that there was a multi-tentacled octopus at work, with one person who was operating all of the tentacles, each one separately, independently from the others. The Shin Bet's new data mining systems, which monitored thousands of Palestinians designated as targets, began to zoom in on one man. The Israelis singled out Adel Awadallah, who had taken over as head of Hamas's military arm in the West Bank, the counterpart to Mohammed Deif in the Gaza Strip. Awadallah had been on the wanted list for some time, but thanks to a Hamas support network known as the Assistance and Service Apparatus, which served as a buffer between him and the cells that he ran, he wasn't caught, even when subordinates were captured and gave away information under interrogation. This support system, which enabled Awadallah to avoid apprehension by the Shin Bet and at the same time launch many terror attacks, was run by Adel's younger brother Imad, who had escaped from a Palestinian Authority prison. The two began planning the next series of terror attacks, the most ambitious of which involved 5 car bombs in the center of Israel's 5 largest cities. According to the plan, the first one would be detonated in Tel Aviv, presumably causing heavy casualties. Then an ultimatum would be presented to the Israeli government. Free all the Palestinian prisoners, or another car would explode, then another, and so on. At the same time, they laid plans for the abduction of soldiers and prominent Israeli political figures. Large amounts of sedative drugs were acquired on the black market for this purpose, to use as bargaining chips. Among the men they intended to kidnap or assassinate were Ehud Olmert, then mayor of Jerusalem, Rafael Eitan, the former IDF chief who had become a Knesset member and cabinet minister, and 2 former Shin Bet directors, Yaakov Peri and Carmi Gilon. Awadallah was a first-class operational leader, but he was not aware of the changes in the Shin Bet, including the stringent surveillance of phone calls, who called whom, when, and precisely where both sides were at the time, so that even though he hardly ever used the phone himself, at least some of the members of his network did, making it possible to map his movements and keep tabs on him. And he never grasped that his main adversary was, in Ami Ayalon's words, the best operational chief the agency had ever had. That man was Yuval Diskin, whom Ayalon had appointed commander of the Jerusalem and West Bank region, the areas where the brothers lived and were most active. Diskin, born in 1956, had done his military service in the Shaked Recon Unit, rising to the position of company commander. In 1978, he joined the Shin Bet and served as a case officer in the Palestinian territories and in Lebanon. His command of Arabic was outstanding, and he excelled at his work and rose rapidly in rank. Diskin was extremely tough and highly critical of both subordinates and superiors. It was clear that if he succeeded in smashing the Hamas terror networks in the West Bank, he'd be a good candidate for director of the Shin Bet. Adel was very suspicious, Diskin said. He relied only on his human communications network, each of whose members had undergone loyalty testing by him. Thanks to them, he survived a few years. Until the last moment, we found it very difficult to get close to him. Adel and Imad's caution came from seeing the fate of Mohi al-Din Sharif and the arrest of many of their comrades. They suspected that a Hamas activist, perhaps even a very senior one, had been collaborating with Israel or with the Palestinian Authority, divulging secrets and, eventually, setting up Sharif. Since no collaborator had been flushed out, the brothers assumed that he might still be active among them. Because of this suspicion, the brothers decided to approach people outside of Hamas, though still known to be loyal to the Palestinian nationalist cause, when they looked for a place to sleep and eat. They settled on a group of activists from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine who, in the past, had served years in an Israeli prison for membership in a terrorist organization and illegal possession of firearms. These activists let the brothers stay in a two-story farmhouse with a large yard, surrounded by a wall, in the village of Hirbet al-Taiba, west of Hebron, which belonged to a member of one of their families. That house quickly became a trove of intelligence information that included the archives of the Hamas military wing, which Adel took with him from hideout to hideout, for fear they would fall into the hands of the Shin Bet. The brothers also brought with them the plans for their next major attack, which included poisoning Tel Aviv's water supply. The Shin Bet managed to identify one of the brothers' contacts in this group of activists and put heavy pressure on him to act as their agent, threatening that if he didn't, he'd be prosecuted for collaborating with Hamas and go to jail for many years. The stick was matched by a big carrot, a hefty payment, and a new and easy life abroad for him and his family if he cooperated. The man agreed. The first task was to get the house wired for video and audio surveillance. Capturing the Awadallas could wait. More important, Diskin believed, was learning precisely what the brothers were planning. The Shin Bet waited for a tip-off from their agent that the brothers were leaving the house. The next time one of the PFLP friends brought the brothers their provisions, they told him they were in a hurry to go somewhere. They all left together, the brothers in one car, and the collaborator in another. The birds were waiting outside, watching. When the cars were out of sight, they went into action. Using a copy of the key, they went inside the house and installed cameras and microphones in every room. The brothers returned later that night. For 4 solid days afterward, every word of the head of Hamas's military wing was recorded. Adel and Imad talked about various tactical improvements they wanted to make to their plan, and the possibility that Hamas would begin making rockets, like the ones that Hezbollah was using. The resulting documentation gave the Israelis not only details about specific plans, but also a sense of the brothers' broader worldview. In one conversation, for example, Imad, who had suffered harsh torture at the hands of Palestinian Authority jailers, spoke with bitter hatred about Yasser Arafat's men. "The next time they come for me," he said, "I'll open fire immediately." His brother, who had been lounging on one of the sofas, leapt to his feet. "Never," he thundered. "We do not shoot Muslims. Do you hear me? Even if they do the most terrible things to you, you do not kill a Muslim." The Shin Bet informed the IDF of its impressive intelligence coup, knowing full well that, at some unpredictable point in time, as a routine security precaution, the brothers would move to another hideout. They also requested an allocation of forces to kill them. The military, however, was not eager to assassinate another Hamas official. The aggressive response to Ayash's death had made them anxious. So instead, Ayalon and the Shin Bet went to the Israel Police Counterterror Unit, the Yamam. There was a long-standing rivalry between Yamam and the IDF's Special Operations Units, and the army rightly interpreted Ayalon's decision to enlist the help of the police as an intentional disparagement. Later on, a disagreement arose between Diskin and Ayalon. Diskin thought the Yamam commando squad should break into the house and kill the two brothers on the spot. Ayalon was, in principle, willing to assassinate them, but he believed that an effort should be made to capture them alive so they could be interrogated, which he was sure would produce a valuable crop of information. In the end, a compromise was reached. If they could find a way to ensure that the two could be caught alive without endangering the Yamam operatives, they would go for it. If not, the two would be killed. Ayalon took the plan to Prime Minister Netanyahu, who was much less decisive than he'd been when the Mossad brought him the assassination plan for Khaled Mashal. He now fully understood that every operation, even ones that seem easy and safe, can fall apart in the execution, with disastrous results for the personnel involved and for the entire nation. The hit on Mohi al-Din Sharif had left no Israeli fingerprints, But this time it was quite possible that the brothers would be killed in the Yamam raid, and Israel would not be able to deny responsibility. Hamas would launch massive retaliatory attacks. Shimon Peres had lost power because of the wave of Hamas terror in the wake of the Ayash assassination. Netanyahu had no desire to risk his own office. He refused to sign the red page. "If we are not willing to take care of the head of the military arm that is operating against us," Ayalon argued to Netanyahu, "what are we worth? If you don't sign the authorization, I will resign as head of the Shin Bet." This was a formidable threat, with repercussions that went beyond the stated position itself. The prime minister was already seen as weak for releasing Sheikh Yassin. The public generally believed that he was not doing a good job in the war on terror. If Ayalon resigned, Netanyahu was sure someone would leak the reason. It would be framed as the prime minister's having refused to eliminate a major threat to the state of Israel and Jews everywhere. He would then be considered even weaker. After a few hours, he signed off on the operation. The plan was to incapacitate the Awadallah brothers before the assault. In one of his conversations picked up by Shin Bet, Imad Awadallah had mentioned his love of baklava. So on the night of September 11, 1998, Shin Bet specialists dosed a baklava with a sedative, then had it delivered to the house in Khirbet al-Tayyibeh. They would wait until the brothers dozed off, then enter the house, load them into a vehicle, and take them to an interrogation facility. It didn't quite work. Imad was overjoyed by the baklava and gorged himself on it. Soon he was overcome by sleep and began to snore. But the Shin Bet wasn't aware that Adele hated baklava and wouldn't touch it. When it became clear from the video surveillance that Adele was not under the influence of the drug and did not intend to go to bed soon, the Imam was given the order to storm the house. The squads surrounding the building moved in from several directions, accompanied by an attack dog. They climbed the wall and broke in. Adele went for his rifle, fired, and hit the dog, but was immediately cut down. Imad, woken by the shooting, tried to reach his weapon and was killed by a long burst of automatic fire. After the Imam gave the all-clear, a birds team entered the house and soon found the archive, hidden in one of the rooms. Ayalon called Netanyahu to tell him that the operation had succeeded and the Awadallahs were dead. To forestall a violent Palestinian reaction, Netanyahu instructed Ayalon to drive to the Mukatta, Palestinian Authority's governmental compound in Ramallah. When he arrived, Arafat was awake and waiting. Ayalon told Arafat that Israel had killed the brothers. "Before he could deny knowing who they were, I said, 'Please, don't ask me Awadallah Shu. We know that you know who they are and what they have done.' Ayalon said, 'In the name of the State of Israel, I demand that you do everything to ensure that Hamas doesn't begin to run wild.'" Arafat asked to have the news of the slayings held up for 4 days so he could get organized. Ayalon informed him that there was nothing he could do to delay the news and that he believed that the Palestinians had no more than 4 hours before the media got hold of the story. "Please give Jibril, Rajoub, and Mohammed, Dahlan, the two heads of the Palestinian security apparatus, who were sitting on either side of Arafat, the order to act now," Ayalon said. "They know what has to be done. If that doesn't happen, and there's a terror attack, Israel will react in the harshest possible manner, including an absolute stop to the peace process." Arafat told his two lieutenants to act decisively. That same night, the leading activists of Hamas were rounded up and held in detention, and the organization was put on notice that any activity against Israel would draw a severe response from the Palestinian Authority. Rajoub and Dahlan did everything they could to assure the Israelis that this time Arafat was serious about carrying out his threats. Meanwhile, Shin Bet desk officers and analysts immediately began poring over the Hamas military archives, plugging names and dates into their computers, all part of an intensive effort aimed at the rapid scrutiny of the archive documents in order to act before the members of the military wing could regroup and go into hiding. Units from the IDF, the Imam, and the Shin Bet itself began rounding up dozens of suspects. Senior commanders, explosives experts, procurers of weapons and materials for bomb manufacture, training and support staff, including liaison personnel and members of the Dawa, the social civilian arm of Hamas. The archives the Awadalla brothers had guarded so closely would now be used to bring Hamas's military infrastructure to the brink of collapse. One of the names gleaned from the Hamas archive was Iyad Batat, a senior military operative focused on attacks inside the West Bank. The records showed that he had been involved in ambushing IDF soldiers on a number of occasions. After several months, the Israelis eventually tracked him down to a safe house in the village Beit Awa. An operation, codenamed Dungeons and Dragons, was drawn up to kill him. Moshe Ya'alon, who had ended his term as head of Amman and was now serving as head of the IDF's central command, came to the operation's forward command post, a large and musty tent near the village Beit Jubrin, not far from Beit Awa, on October 19, 1999. Though his operatives had already had 3 days to plan, he immediately realized that they had only a fraction of the intelligence they needed. No one from Unit 8200, Amman's SIGINT arm, was there, nor anyone from Unit 9900 to operate the drones. Even if they had been there, there were no monitors on which the information could be presented. The Shin Bet's relevant intelligence officer was in another area, and access to him depended on the fluctuating quality of his cell phone reception. "I come from another place, another culture," Ya'alon said, referring to Sayeret Matkal, which he had once commanded, "and there things are conducted differently." It was inconceivable that someone else should know something relevant to the operation, and it would not be available to the commander of the force about to go into action. Ya'alon and Diskin decided that it was unacceptably risky to continue. They canceled the operation and put a temporary hold on all efforts to kill Batat. "In Beit Awa, we realized that we had been totally dumb," Diskin said. "We asked ourselves what had to be done to ensure that next time, we wouldn't be." In theory, the solution was simple. Put all the necessary people in the command post so they could talk to one another and watch monitors displaying a single summary of the data. The Shin Bet, Yamam, IDF commando units, Matkal, Flotilla 13, Cherry Dovdevan, Amman's 8200, 504, and 9900, and eventually the Air Force, would all be stationed in one room, under fluorescent lights, not in some miserable tent, Diskin said, into which all of the available and necessary data would flow. However, the implementation of the solution was difficult because of a number of issues of accountability, command, and control. The various arms of the military and intelligence services had become accustomed over the years to functioning in parallel. And because the operatives came from different units, they spoke in different professional jargons. At times, some people were also just more concerned with turf than with national security. Diskin in the Shin Bet and Ya'alon in the military had to shatter quite a few entrenched bureaucratic procedures and navigate various interpersonal difficulties to get everyone into the second floor space of the Jerusalem Shin Bet headquarters, which would now be called, appropriately, the Joint War Room, JWR. Especially tough was the resistance of 8200, the glamorous SIGINT unit of Amman, who tried to insist that Shin Bet come to them instead. On December 11, 1999, everything was ready for action. Information reaching the Shin Bet indicated that Batat was due to go to his safe house in Beit Awa in the next few days. The house and its environs were placed under close surveillance. As a security precaution, Batat did not carry a phone, but his driver had one, and the Shin Bet tracked it. They saw it come to the house on December 13, stopping there for a while, and then moving on, apparently after dropping someone off. A camera in a drone overhead also saw the car stop and saw someone get out of it and enter the house. Information coming in from an agent indicated that Batat had posted a camouflaged lookout on the roof of the house to warn him of any danger. This intel was fed into the JWR computers, and heat sensors in the drones were then activated, which showed that there was indeed a man sitting under a shelter on the roof. Taking all this information into account, soldiers of the Cherry Unit, disguised as Arabs, took up positions at a number of spots around the house. Four of them took cover under a little staircase along an outside wall, close enough to the entrance, but hidden from the lookout on the roof. 11 o'clock at night. The village is asleep. At first, there's adrenaline, and you aren't scared, and later, when you're in position, the fear begins. Alon Castile, one of the raiders, recounted. We received permission to open fire from the commander of the unit. We killed Batat's man on the roof of the house. There were some exchanges of fire. After the firing, we executed freeze, ceasefire, to get some intelligence. Then more noise from the house, and Iyad Batat comes out with a handgun. The whole force identified him and opened fire. Afterward, the IDF put out a brief statement saying that one of its units had encountered Batat, and another wanted Hamas man and killed them. The purpose of the statement was to cover up the vast intelligence activity that had taken place behind the scenes. But to the Israelis themselves, it was clear that the Shin Bet's reforms and the JWR were proving effective. Over the next 9 months, the JWR model was used in 15 different arrest and targeted killing operations. This model was based on total transparency among agencies and a system of baton passing from one agency to the next as an operation unfolded. The first principle of the JWR model calls for the presence of all the sensors, the intelligence gathering agencies connected to the operation, in the form of both actual representatives and real-time feeds of the information they produce. The Shin Bet put a great deal of work into integrating all of the relevant computer systems, the innumerable hardware and software elements utilized by many different intelligence and operational bodies, so that they would interface with one another and communicate with the IT equipment in the war room. The goal was to have all the data displayed in a manner that would create a single, easily digestible picture of the situation. This intelligence superiority, the concentration of all possible sources, lies at the foundation of our ability to hit our targets, said Ya'alon. To implement the second principle, passing the baton, the war room was in effect divided in two. One part, under the control of the Shin Bet, was called the intelligence war room. It was here that the target of the operation was identified. In other words, the intelligence war room's responsibility was to point out the specific location of the target and to guarantee that he was, in fact, the right person. This part was termed framing. Once there was a positive identification, the baton was passed on to the second part of the war room, the operational section. For the most part, this was the responsibility of the IDF, which supervised the execution of the hit. At first, most of the targeted killings were carried out by ground forces. Later, execution passed into the hands of the Air Force, but the general principle remained the same. In cases where the baton has been passed on to the operational war room, but something has happened on the ground that hinders the capability of hitting the target, such as a temporary loss of the surveillance picture, responsibility returns to the intelligence war room, and the framing procedure starts over from the beginning. And so on. Until execution. In September 2000, 2 months after Diskin had been appointed deputy director of the Shin Bet and Ya'alon had been named deputy chief of the IDF general staff, the two recommended that the model they had developed for the Central Command region be replicated for the entire country, that a permanent war room be set up for implementing major operations and targeted killings. The proposal was accepted, and space was set aside inside a building under construction at the Shin Bet headquarters in North Tel Aviv. The timing was fortuitous. If we had not implemented the technological revolution and hadn't set up the special war room, Diskin said, it's doubtful whether and how we would have coped with the huge challenge that was posed for us by the Second Intifada. Chapter 28 All-out war. Benjamin Netanyahu did not wait for the final results of the elections. On May 17, 1999, shortly after the TV exit polls began indicating a clear victory for the Labour Party and its leader, Ehud Barak, Netanyahu announced his retirement from political life. Netanyahu had been elected because of Hamas suicide bombings, but his years as prime minister had been marked by a series of political scandals, coalition crises, security debacles like the Mashal affair, and a diplomatic dead end with the Palestinians. Barak was perceived by the electorate as Netanyahu's exact opposite. The IDF's most decorated soldier, a disciple of and successor to Yitzhak Rabin, who had promised to get the army out of Lebanon and to bring peace. In his victory speech, Barak said that it was the dawn of a new day, as he stood before hundreds of thousands of supporters in Tel Aviv's Central Plaza, now called Rabin Square, after the prime minister who'd been assassinated there 4 years earlier. Peace is a common interest, and it bears within it enormous benefits for both peoples, Barak told the Knesset a few months later, declaring, "True peace with Syria and the Palestinians is the peak of the realization of the Zionist vision." With his tremendous energy, decisiveness, and sense of purpose, Barak set about implementing his policies. Once the master of special ops, he was imbued with self-confidence and sure that he could plan diplomatic maneuvers the same way he had planned targeted killing operations behind enemy lines, with strict attention to detail, careful planning to anticipate all possible contingencies, and aggressive action when necessary. But it turned out that although these methods worked well on a small scale, they did not always work with complex international processes. And Barak seldom listened to the advice of his aides. Under America's aegis, Israel engaged in negotiations with Syria. Acting as Barak's emissary, President Clinton met with President Hafez al-Assad in Geneva on March 26, 2000. Clinton told Assad that Barak was willing to withdraw from the entire Golan Heights, except for some very minor border adjustments, in exchange for peace. Though Clinton's language was somewhat less enthusiastic and alluring than might have been expected. Assad, who came to the meeting suffering from a variety of ailments, including incipient dementia and exhaustion, was more obdurate than ever about getting every inch back. The encounter blew up only a few minutes after the two presidents had finished initial formalities and begun discussing the substance of the dispute. Barak had to keep his promise and pull out of Lebanon, but without any agreement with either Syria or Lebanon. In order to prevent Hezbollah from exploiting the retreat to kill a large number of IDF troops, however, it had to be carried out overnight and kept a complete surprise. Shortly before the pullout, Amman managed to locate Imad Mughniyeh, Hezbollah's military chief and number one on Israel's wanted list, as he conducted tours of inspection along the confrontation lines in southern Lebanon, to see whether Barak was about to keep his promise and pull out, and to prepare his militia for the day after. They planned to have him assassinated. But Barak, who came to the northern border and met with top military officials there on May 22 for an urgent consultation, ordered them only to continue intelligence surveillance of the Object M, and not to strike him, in effect liquidating the entire project. Barak's first priority was to make sure the retreat was carried out without any casualties, and he feared that assassinating Mughniyeh would provoke Hezbollah into bombarding Israeli communities or launching major attacks against Israeli targets abroad, which would require an Israeli response and make a quiet, surprise retreat all but impossible. Barak was right, at least in the short term. The day after the meeting at the northern border, he ordered the immediate withdrawal of the IDF from Lebanon. The entire withdrawal was carried out without any casualties. But Nasrallah celebrated the withdrawal as a complete victory for his side, depicting the Israelis as cowardly and fearful, running away from Mughniyeh's army. "Israel is feebler than a spider's web," he crowed. "A spirit of defeatism is prevalent in Israeli society. The Jews are a lot of financiers and not a people capable of sacrifice." In retrospect, The end of the Israeli occupation in Lebanon came at the worst possible moment for Barak. He saw that he couldn't reach a deal with the Syrians, so he decided to speed up the handling of the Palestinian situation. But there were many Palestinians who saw the retreat from Lebanon as proof that guerrilla tactics and terrorism could defeat the strongest military and intelligence forces in the Middle East, and they began contemplating the possibility of applying these methods to their own arena. Clinton invited Barak and Arafat to Camp David in July 2000 in order to hold marathon negotiations and, hopefully, reach a peace agreement. I knew that such an agreement had to include a Palestinian state and a compromise in Jerusalem, Barak said, and I was ready for that. I was sure I would be able to persuade the public in Israel that it was to our advantage, but there was no other option. Arafat, for his part, did not want to come, and he agreed only after Clinton promised him that he would not be blamed if the talks failed. During this time, Israeli intelligence indicated that ferment among the Palestinians had reached new heights. The Palestinian Authority was reported to be making preparations for an armed confrontation with Israel in order to pressure it into making far-reaching concessions. We were not preparing, and we did not intend to start a confrontation with Israel, but hope is by nature an expensive commodity, said Jibril Rajoub, quoting Thucydides. Barak told his associates, we're on a giant ship that's about to collide with an iceberg, and we will manage to divert it only if we succeed at Camp David. The atmosphere at the meetings was festive. Barak was ready for concessions that left the American participants open-mouthed and overjoyed, including a major compromise that would have given the Palestinians parts of East Jerusalem and international rule over the Temple Mount, the site of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. No Israeli leader had ever agreed to give away so much, or to make compromises on matters that until then had been considered taboo. But Barak hadn't done enough in advance to prepare the ground for the meeting. He hadn't tried to get the broader Arab world to press Arafat to compromise on Palestinian principles, like the right of return of refugees. He also behaved in a manner that was perceived as bossy, and conducted the negotiations with Arafat via emissaries, even though his cabin was no more than a few hundred yards away. Arafat refused to sign, perhaps because he thought he would get better terms from Israel if he held out, or perhaps because he simply didn't see any Arab leader ever backing a compromise with the great enemy. Clinton blew up in anger. He ended the summit and broke his promise to Arafat not to blame him for the failure. If Clinton had adopted Carter's strategy and knocked their heads together until they agreed to a compromise, history would have been different, said Itamar Rabinovich, one of Israel's top Middle East scholars and diplomats. In the ensuing 2 months, attempts were made to bridge the gaps. But by now the tension and suspicion between the two sides had passed the point of no return. We were living with the feeling that we were breathing gunpowder, said one of Barak's close associates. And wherever there is gunpowder, there'll be a pyromaniac to set it alight. This time, the pyromaniac was Ariel Sharon. What the Jews call the Temple Mount and the Muslims call the Noble Sanctuary is perhaps the most sensitive place in the world today. Located inside Jerusalem's old city, it is revered as the site of the rock from which God created the world, and where he called upon Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac. It is also where the first and second Jewish temples stood, where Jesus walked and preached, and where Muslims believe the prophet Muhammad took off on his flight to heaven with the angel Gabriel. The Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque stand there today. Over the years, many confrontations have flared up there. In 1982, a group of Jewish terrorists plotted to blow up the Dome of the Rock, to remove the abomination, as they put it, in the hope that the act would lead to a world war, thus hastening the coming of the Messiah. Though they failed in their mission, the strategy was not entirely off base. Any incident on the Temple Mount would be a snowball that could quickly set off an avalanche. Ariel Sharon was aware of all this. As the leader of the opposition to Barak's administration, he decided to defy in the most flagrant manner possible, Barak's readiness to give up Israeli sovereignty over the Temple Mount. On September 28, he led a group of Likud politicians, surrounded by hundreds of police officers, to a demonstration at the holy site. He declared, "It is the right of every Jew in Israel to visit and pray on the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount is ours." The Palestinians who were there at the time called out to him, "Butcher of Beirut, murderer of children and women," and very soon they clashed with the police who were guarding Sharon. By the time of the next morning's prayers, Radio Palestine broadcasts and sermons in the mosques were already sharply condemning what they said was an Israeli attempt to harm Islam's holy places. A crowd of 20,000, mostly young men, angrily awaited the commencement of prayers at Al-Aqsa. Many of them were armed with rocks and other objects, and they began to hurl them at police and down onto the Jewish worshippers at the Western Wall. In those riots, 7 Palestinians were killed and more than 100 were wounded. The next day, the violence had spread across the occupied Palestinian territories and the Arab-populated areas of Israel. 12 Israeli Arab men and boys were killed, along with a Palestinian and an Israeli Jew. Within a short while, the local clashes had become a war. Inside Israeli intelligence, the argument over what was going on in Yasser Arafat's mind flared up once again. The heads of Amman and the IDF, especially Moshe Ya'alon, believed that the Intifada was part of a sophisticated and pre-planned strategy of Arafat's, and that he controlled the height of the flames from his office, at first with spontaneous demonstrations organized by his people, then with gunfire at Israeli troops from inside the crowds, then with planned shooting attacks against soldiers and settlers, and finally with suicide bombings inside Israel. Arafat was trying to attain diplomatic achievements by means of spilling Israeli blood, said the chief of staff at the time, Lieutenant General Shaul Mofaz. On the other side, the Shin Bet believed that Arafat had never had any such strategy, and that the war had begun as a spontaneous outburst by students frustrated by a number of issues, some of them intra-Palestinian, who were then egged on by local leaders. The demonstrations led to a sharp response by the IDF, which was over-prepared for the outbreak of violence. That response left a large number of Palestinians dead or wounded, and led to further deterioration. Arafat, the Shin Bet claimed, was being dragged along by the tide of events. Yossi Avrahami was an independent businessman from Petah Tikva, 38 years old, married, with 3 children. In his spare time, he volunteered as an auxiliary traffic cop. Vadim Nursits was 3 years younger, a native of Irkutsk in Russia, and a truck driver by occupation. Neither was a professional soldier, but, like many Jewish Israelis, they were reservists, on permanent standby to reinforce the IDF. The Second Intifada, as the latest war between Israel and the Palestinians became known, required reinforcements. Avrahami and Nursits were called up on October 1, 2000, to guard settlers' school buses from attacks by Palestinians. On October 11, they were given a one-day furlough. The next day, on their way back to their base in Nursits' car, they took a wrong turn and ended up in the West Bank city of Ramallah. There had been some rioting in Ramallah in the preceding weeks, and a number of Palestinians had been killed by IDF gunfire. Tension was running high. When the car entered the city, passers-by saw the yellow Israeli license plates and began throwing stones at it. The two tried to flee but were blocked by traffic. Palestinian policemen dragged them from their car at gunpoint, confiscated their weapons, and took them to a police station for questioning. Then they left them at the mercy of a raging lynch mob that had gathered outside. The two reservists were beaten, their eyes were gouged out, and they were stabbed multiple times. Nursits' head was bashed in before he was disemboweled with a stick shoved down his throat, and his body was set on fire. When Avrahami's wife, unaware of what had happened, called his cell phone, one of the killers told her, "I slaughtered your husband a few minutes ago." One of the Palestinians was photographed at the second-floor window of the police station, ecstatically exhibiting his bloody hands to the cheering crowd below. The mob then dumped the bodies through the window onto the ground and dragged them through the city. The event left a profound impression on the public in Israel, which quite rightly blamed the Palestinian Authority, whose personnel had not provided protection for the Israelis in their territory, but had instead arrested them without any reason, and had allowed the mob to murder them inside the police station. The Shin Bet designated the lynching an emblematic attack, whose perpetrators had to be hunted down in perpetuity, like those responsible for the massacre of the Israelis at the Munich Olympics. The hunt went on for months and years afterward. Even more significantly, in the eyes of many in the Israeli leadership, the attack was seen as a fundamental betrayal, proof that the Palestinian Authority's goal, and by extension Arafat's goal, was not actually peace, but conflict. From that point forward, the PA and Arafat himself would be treated as part of the problem. In the wake of the Ramallah lynch mob, the IDF greatly stepped up its use of force. Firearms were used more frequently against rioting protesters. The IDF hit back against Palestinian policemen, too, blowing up police stations at night when they were empty. By the end of 2000, 276 Palestinians would be killed. The bloodshed was a political disaster for Ehud Barak. Already hobbled by the failure at Camp David, the uprising left him unmoored and ineffectual. He openly and repeatedly blamed Arafat for what had happened, but that only made him look like more of a failure to the Israeli public for having trusted the Palestinian leader in the first place. And his insistence on continuing the peace process with Arafat brought his popularity level down to unprecedented depths. Close associates described the last months of his term as manic, lacking in focus, and devoid of any clear sense of direction. His governing coalition began to unravel, and in December, he was forced to call for elections in February 2001. Barak was defeated by the very man whose provocation at the Temple Mount had kick-started the Intifada, Ariel Sharon. Sharon had been a political pariah for almost two decades, ever since he orchestrated the disastrous invasion of Lebanon. He'd been forced to abdicate the office of defense minister in 1983, but his misbegotten military adventure, his foolhardy plan to rearrange the whole of the Middle East, dragged on for 18 years, costing Israel 1,216 lives and more than 5,000 wounded, as well as untold thousands of Lebanese casualties. Large crowds of Israelis protesting in the streets had called him a murderer and a war criminal. The United States had imposed an unofficial boycott on him. Only junior U.S. officials were allowed to meet with him when he was in America, and even then, only at his hotel, outside of regular work hours. The man who never stopped on red, as the song went, was publicly scorned and widely loathed for years, despite serving in the Knesset and as a cabinet minister. But Sharon saw politics as a Ferris wheel. "Sometimes you're up, and sometimes you're down," he used to say. "Just stay on it." In early 2001, when Israelis were desperate for a strong leader who could stop the violence, he defeated Barak by 25%. The contrast was immediately evident. Aides who remained in the prime minister's office after Barak left said the atmosphere immediately became calmer and steadier. Sharon was the complete opposite of Barak, warm, attentive to moods and personal quirks, careful to show respect toward everyone. He was naturally suspicious, but as soon as he came to feel that someone could be trusted, he gave them a great deal of freedom. He also felt it deeply whenever Israelis or Jews anywhere were killed in a terror attack. "I would come in with news about this or that suicide attack," said Military Secretary Yoav Gallant, and see how his heart was crushed. It pained him in the most personal way. Any child or woman or man in Israel who was murdered on a bus or in a mall, he would take it as if they were his relatives, his family. Sharon marked a seemingly clear path to end the violence. He radiated to us all confidence that we were about to win this war, the war on terror, Gallant said. As Napoleon said, the Roman legions didn't cross the Rubicon. Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon. Sharon was a leader, and he led the war on terror. Immediately after assuming the premiership, Sharon declared that political negotiations would not take place while the terror attacks continued. Only when calm was achieved, he said, would Israel return to the negotiating table. At the same time, he pressed the IDF and the Shin Bet to step up their operations. Think outside of the box, he told the commanders. Come to me with creative ideas. He repeatedly reminded them of his own tumultuous times in Unit 101 in the 1950s, and of how Meir Dagan, under Sharon's command, had successfully hunted terrorists in the 1970s. Since his stint as defense minister in the early 1980s, Sharon had had his doubts about the IDF's capabilities, harboring a suspicion that it had lost its fortitude over the years. He was mistrustful of army officers as well, perhaps because he remembered how he himself had lied to the politicians when he was in uniform, deceiving his superiors so they would allow him to carry out operations. Now that he was prime minister, he felt that IDF officers were scared of failing, and he was therefore convinced that senior commanders were lying to him, so they would not have to take responsibility, said Gallant. On the other hand, Sharon felt much more comfortable with the Shin Bet, and he had great confidence in its chief, Avi Dichter. In the war against terror, the first and most important matter on his agenda, Sharon increasingly relied on the agency, giving it more missions and authority. At the beginning of the Second Intifada, a significant number of people who'd been involved in terror attacks over the previous decade were sitting in prisons operated by the Palestinian Authority. After the suicide attacks of 1996 toppled Shimon Peres's government and disrupted the peace process, Arafat had realized that he needed to keep the top Hamas and Islamic Jihad leaders behind bars for at least as long as he was negotiating with the Israelis. But over 6 months, starting in October 2001, Arafat ordered their release. Once again, the IDF believed that Arafat was trying to instigate more attacks on Israel, while the Shin Bet believed he was just frantically trying to avoid losing the support of the Palestinians to Hamas. By that point, hundreds of Palestinians had been killed in the Intifada, while only a handful of IDF soldiers and settlers had lost their lives. Hamas's suicide attacks, however, were starting to even the scales. The more the suicide attacks increased and succeeded, support for Hamas grew in direct proportion, said Yuval Diskin, the Shin Bet deputy chief. The loss of the Awadallah brothers and of its archives had been a powerful blow, but Hamas had begun to rebuild under the leadership of Sheikh Yassin. And as it rebuilt, it began using suicide attacks against Israeli civilians more and more. On May 18, 2001, a Hamas operative wearing a long, dark blue coat came to the security checkpoint outside the Hasharon Mall near Netanya. He aroused the suspicion of the guards, who stopped him from entering, and then blew himself up, killing 5 bystanders. On June 1, another suicide bomber killed 21 young people, most of them new Jewish immigrants from Russia, in the line outside a discotheque on the beach in Tel Aviv. The owner of the dance hall, Shlomo Cohen, had served in the naval commandos, "But this was the worst thing I had seen in my life," he said, with despair in his eyes. By early November, suicide bombers were striking in the streets of Israel almost every week, and sometimes every few days. On December 1, 3 bombers in succession killed 11 people in Jerusalem's Ben Yehuda pedestrian mall, the same place where a suicide attack in 1997 had led to the attempted assassination of Khaled Mashal. The next day, a man from Nablus blew himself up on a bus in Haifa, killing 15 and wounding 40. "We are facing an all-out offensive," the Northern District Police Commander said when he reached the scene. The offensive did not stop. In March 2002 alone, 138 men, women, and children were killed by suicide bombers, and 683 were wounded. The most atrocious of the attacks occurred on Passover, on the ground floor of the Park Hotel in Netanya, where a Seder banquet was being held for 250 of the city's disadvantaged people. A suicide bomber dressed as a religious Jewish woman entered the hall and blew himself up, killing 30. The youngest aged 20, and the oldest 90, and wounding 143 others. George Dekubovits, a Hungarian-born Nazi death camp survivor, was there with his wife, Anna, also a Holocaust survivor from Hungary. They were celebrating Seder night with Andrei Fried, Anna's son from a previous marriage, and his wife, Edith. All four were killed. The year 2002 was, according to Shin Bet Chief Dichter, the worst year for terror attacks against us since the establishment of the state. Chief of Staff Mofaz said, "This was a national trauma. It cast upon us loss of life, damage to our national security, damage to our economy. There was no tourism. People were scared to go to shopping malls, scared to sit in restaurants, and didn't ride in buses." The Israeli intelligence community had come across suicide bombers before, but we did not realize that it could be done in such huge numbers, said Major General Yitzhak Ben Yisrael, head of the Administration for the Development of Weapons and Technological Infrastructure, Maf'at in Hebrew, at the Israeli Ministry of Defense. "Even when we grasped that this was the main threat, we had no solution for it, neither in combat doctrine nor in weaponry. What can you do against a suicide bomber when he's already walking around in your streets looking for somewhere to blow himself up?" Terrorism in general, and suicide attacks in particular, created a strange and frustrating situation within the Shin Bet and IDF. "Unequivocally, there was a sense of impotence," said the head of the IDF planning directorate at the time, Major General Giora Eiland. "The frustration was huge. We were under great pressure to do something, both from above, the IDF command and the political echelon, and from below, officers and soldiers in the field. And your neighbors and relatives and people in the street stopping you and asking, 'Where are you military commanders? A 50 billion shekel budget. What do you do with the money? What do you do with yourselves all day?'" In the absence of any larger strategy for how to respond to the suicide terrorism offensive, the Shin Bet just continued doing what it had always done, assassinating the people instigating and organizing the terror. During the first year of the Intifada, the hits were carried out in a diffuse manner, without any clear direction. The first one took place shortly after the Intifada began, when the Shin Bet discovered that a Fatah operative by the name of Hussein Abayat was behind many of the shooting attacks on the roads in the West Bank and in the Jerusalem neighborhood of Gilo. Since the lynching in Ramallah, all the areas under the control of the Palestinian Authority had been designated hostile territory, in which it was necessary to operate with extreme caution and with the support of large IDF forces. But entering with such a large force in order to arrest or kill Abayat would give him time to flee to a hideout. The only way to reach him, the Israelis concluded, was with a combined operation using an undercover commando force and an attack from the air. The Air Force Commando Unit Kingfisher, Shaldag in Hebrew, which designated targets by laser deep behind enemy lines, was assigned to the operation. It was selected because, at the time, it was the only available unit trained to act in close cooperation with the Air Force. On November 9, 2000, Abayat was seen by a Palestinian Shin Bet source getting into his black Mercedes and leaving the village of Beit Sahur, near Bethlehem, with some of his men. A Shin Bet operative accompanying the source was in touch with the Joint War Room, and the JWR was in touch with the Air Force and the Land Forces. Kingfisher spotters designated the vehicle with laser markers for two formations of two Apache helicopters each, who were following at a distance. The car stopped at a house, and a crowd gathered around it. "We waited a few minutes until it moved off again and away from the people," the deputy commander of the Apache squadron said. "Then we fired two missiles. I fired one, and the second was fired by the squadron commander, who was leading the other formation. They both hit the target. Until then, we had executed